More drones exploded over the Ukrainian capital of Kyiv last night. Residents were urged to stay in shelters and safe places. But a wave of Russian attacks over the weekend has left at least 4 civilians dead. And it raises questions about what lies ahead. Just a few months ago, Ukraine staged a daring counteroffensive deep into Russian-held territory to Kharkiv in the northeast of Ukraine. But those who thought that was the beginning of the end of the conflict were wrong. The Washington Post's Ukraine bureau chief Isabel Kershudian co-wrote a deep dive into that counteroffensive, and she joins us now from Kyiv. Hi, Isabel.
Hi, thanks for having me.
It's great to have you, and I wonder what's significant about this counteroffensive in a war that's lasted nearly a year. Why focus on this particular military action?
This is what really kind of turned the whole tide of the war. To that point, Ukraine had shown that it could defend itself against Russia and really shocked, you know, really the whole world of how well it was defending itself, but it didn't show yet that it could take back territory, that it had kind of the forces not just to hold on, but to maybe even win.
So there are so many fascinating details in your piece, but can you tell us a little bit about the preparation, how Ukrainians designed their counteroffensive, how they decided whether they could accomplish it?
Yeah, they were looking for some sort of diversionary action because at that point, the Russians had moved a lot of their best forces to the south to defend the Kherson region. And Ukraine wanted to kind of draw up some sort of, you know, operation that would force the Russians not to do that, to bring some of their forces out of Kherson so that the Ukrainians could then push in the south. So, you know, General Sirsky, who's Ukraine's commander of ground forces, comes up with this operation in the Kharkiv region, and he sees that there's not a ton of forces there anymore. And in fact, this operation could work, not just as a distraction, but as a real kind of offensive of its own. And at that point, there's some collaboration with the U.S. as far as intelligence, how many, you know, actual battalions of Russians are there, as well as what the targets are. But when they designed the operation for 6 days, they printed out these humongous 3D maps and had every commander actually walk the path on these 3D maps that they would take, and, you know, they had it planned down to the hour. Like, by this hour, you need to be, you know, in this village. By this hour, you need to be here.
When you say massive, I want to give listeners an idea. It was 520 square feet that they would walk around.
Yeah, and because their feet were actually walking on the map, they could sense, you know, okay, here we're going to have to go uphill. Here is a river, so we're going to have to go around. And it really gave each commander, down to the battalion level, a real sense of how to explain this, you know, to their men and how they would plan it and how much time everything would take.
So one of the things that really comes through is not only how creative the Ukrainian forces have had to be, but they seem to be a little proud of the fact that they sometimes MacGyver solutions. Can you give me an example of some of the things that they've done, proving that necessity is the mother of invention?
Yeah, in the south, the 59th Brigade commander told us that he had received, you know, drones from drug smugglers. And, you know, now they had donated these drones. They rigged some other drones to be able to fly, you know, further than they should be capable of.
Yeah, they gave them new batteries, right? Longer lasting batteries.
Exactly. And give themselves better recon for kind of less of the price. They even, just to distract the Russians and make them think a strike was coming from one direction when it was really coming from the other, they would move, you know, these pontoon bridges. They would put out all of this misinformation. So even though they're a smaller force, they're pretty creative in how they're able to kind of make gains on the battlefield.
So you spoke with a 21-year-old Ukrainian company commander who didn't want you to use his last name. Why was that?
Because his family is still in the Lugansk region, which is now the territory that, you know, his company is trying to liberate.
So tell me a little bit about the stories he said. I was especially struck by his description of being prepared to meet fierce Russian defense and not. When they rolled into some of these towns, what did they find?
Yeah, so their company went first through, you know, the Kharkiv counteroffensive. Their company was the first ones into Izyum, which had been this military stronghold for the Russians, and they had really used it as kind of a base of their operations in the east. And they get there, and there's all these tanks in working order. Some of them have, you know, are completely fueled up. They could have gotten on them. They could have fought, and they just didn't. They ran out of there. And a large reason of that is that there wasn't a cavalry coming. There wasn't backup coming. The Russians had left that area in northeast Ukraine pretty vulnerable because they had moved so many forces to the south. And so that's why in the aftermath of this, Putin's kind of forced into this political decision that is pretty uncomfortable for him in Russia, where he has to announce a mobilization of, you know, 300,000 men. It leads to this mass exodus of people. But that was all kind of exposed in that Kharkiv region where, you know, soldiers, Russian soldiers, really just ran off on anything they could find, but left so much equipment that Ukrainian forces now use themselves.
Incredible. Besides trying to get 300,000 more troops onto the battlefield, what other things did Vladimir Putin do in response? Because I have to assume that he was as surprised as the rest of the world at how successful the Ukrainians were in this counteroffensive.
Yeah, there was a huge ripple effect. I mean, it did lead to some friction within the Kremlin. He changes the main commander to General Surovikin. He announces, you know, this annexation of Kherson, Zaporizhia, Lugansk, and Donetsk regions that even though they don't control, at the time they didn't control the whole of any of those regions, and now they control even less of it. You know, he forces him to kind of double down because he's facing so much political pressure at home for the war not going well.
So a little bit heartbreaking was how many times people in told you that they thought this counteroffensive, which happened in August of last year, was the beginning of the end of the war. Even President Zelensky of Ukraine said that. Why wasn't it? What happened?
Well, I think ultimately just they ran into more resistance. Russia now does have more men on the battlefield, and they've also pulled back to more advantageous lines. Now they've kind of, you know, positioned themselves where it's going to be hard to really make any gains, especially in the winter. And that's why there was this rush by the Ukrainians to take as much territory as they could before the winter weather got difficult. And you're just kind of seeing it where there's fierce fighting in several spots, but neither side's really able to make a lot of movement. Unfortunately, the more time that goes by, the more ability Russia has to kind of regroup itself and make a push eventually back. So I think for the Ukrainians, they are now kind of stuck. They have taken a lot of losses of their own. And it is a question of what's next. Where do you make the next offensive when there doesn't appear to be any weak spots along the Russian lines anymore?
So I want to end by having your reaction to what both presidents have said may come. Ukrainian President Volodymyr Zelensky has had two major successes at this point, not just this counteroffensive, but also preventing Russians from taking Kyiv early on, as was expected. And so in his New Year's Day address, he predicted there would be a year of return, with soldiers returning to families and refugees returning to their homes. How is that message being received in Ukraine?
I think people are hopeful that is true. But I think people here also kind of understand that this might be a very long and painful process, that there might be another year very similar to this one where, I mean, even in cities far from the front line, people are dealing with kind of the effects of war, from missile strikes on energy infrastructure, from, you know, not having power at home most of the day. Ukrainians have adapted to a lot of this, but understand that victory is going to be very difficult, and it means patience. And they might not be in that much of a different place, you know, when 2024 comes around.
So then let's go to what Putin has predicted. He says there will be hard and necessary decisions ahead, and predicted fateful events in his New Year's Day address. What does that mean to you?
I think he's also trying to prepare his people that, you know, there could be more mobilization, but that Russia is not going to back down. I think their goals for the invasion haven't changed. And what he is saying is maybe it's not going as we had hoped, as quickly as we wanted to, but we can outlast the Ukrainians.
Isabel Krishudian is Ukraine bureau chief for our editorial partners, The Washington Post. Isabel, thank you so much.
Thank you.